The Israel Report for the latest news and insights with Anthony Reich.
Anthony Reich, a very, very good morning. Tell me you're not going to whine as well on Whiny Wednesday.
I'm hoping not. I'm going to say Chodesh Tov to try and keep Bev on the right side of her SMS messages. And I'm not going to be singing Misha Misha Nichnas Adar, but we'll just say Misha Nichnas Adar Marbim Besimcha. I mean, we are supposed to be a little happier.
Yes,
and
Bev.
Of course, Purim is coming up soon. So I think that it sounds happy enough to me for Adar, to be honest with you, even without having some tunes to go with it.
Exactly. You know, sometimes less is more, hey, Anthony?
Well, exactly. And just one of the fascinating sort of COVID stories, if we're already going to be talking about COVID-19 stories and we're not going to be talking about Italy, but apparently people are preparing in Israel for a shortage of matzah over Pesach because of COVID-19. Now you ask, how are the two
linked? It's a good thing or a bad thing.
Thank goodness for COVID.
I don't know how to respond to that, if that's a good thing or a bad thing.
Could it go for the Shmura matzah first?
Well, apparently, the reason that we're preparing for a shortage of matzah is because a lot of people who would usually travel away from Israel over Pesach are not going to be traveling because of COVID-19. And so, therefore, there's going to be much greater demand for matzah than there has been in previous years on Pesach. And therefore, apparently, a possible shortage.
Or is it possible that maybe matzah is made in China and we just didn't know?
Well, the Shmura Matzah for sure, Howard. Maybe you'll find some in Venice and Florence when you eventually get there for your wedding celebrations.
But Anthony, I see your Prime Minister has stopped shaking people's hands over the coronavirus.
Yeah. Interesting.
Well, you know, it's fascinating how people respond to this in different ways. On the one hand, people are anti the idea of wearing masks because there has been a story somewhere, and there was actually a question and answer session in Hebrew on some website which said masks are not good for you. In fact, they can be harmful to you because it gets moisture around the area where you breathe, and that moisture that gathers on the mask could potentially attract bugs and viruses. And so, you know, some people are saying, well, you should wear a mask, but only in airports, and you should throw them away and not reuse them. I've seen some of these pictures with little kind of breathing apparatus on the mask itself. But on the other hand, people are going nuts with, you know, using this alcohol gel stuff to wash your hands 1,000 times a day. So don't wear a mask, but wash your hands as much as you can. I don't know. Everybody's got their little idiosyncrasy that they feel that they've got to implement in order to somehow do something against potentially being infected. But, of course, in Israel, we do have these infections. Fascinating that one of the Israelis who was infected on that ship in Japan and was hospitalized in Japan has now recovered and has been cleared to return home, having recovered from the virus. So that's quite an interesting good news story rather than a bad news story that we always hear from around COVID virus.
I mean, the truth is that that most people do recover from it. And I, of course, I understand the need to try and contain it as much as possible. The reality is that the mortality rate is not that alarming. So although I say it on our show that if it comes to South Africa, we're all going to die. There's no question about it.
Howard, you're going to die anyway. Well, probably not from COVID.
One of your listeners. No, on the other hand, as I said to our listeners in Zanati earlier, we do have people standing at airports with handheld thermometers. Now, with that kind of ironclad, impenetrable shield, you know, it'll never make it into the country as long as you take off your glasses, because that's what they ask you to do when they point it at your head to take your temperature. So, you know, I feel very confident.
The statistics show that most of the casualties are elderly people or people who are ill or, you know, unwell from other things and whose natural resistance to these things is impaired in any event.
What's very, the cutoff age?
Child,
I'm very worried about Howard Feldman. What is the cutoff age?
No, I look older than I am, so it's fine. It's fine. It's not a problem.
Well, none of us in this conversation, Howard, have any room to speak. We'll just leave it at that.
Absolutely right. And speaking of mortality, former Egyptian president Hosni Mubarak has died. He was he was 91 years old. Very, very interesting in terms of his relationship with Israel. Very complex relationship, wasn't it?
It was, and very fascinating, because let's not forget that Hosni Mubarak was an Air Force pilot, and that his job effectively was completely destroyed by the 1967 war when Israel destroyed the Egyptian Air Force. He was left literally without a plane to fly and without a job as a result of the 1967 Six-Day War, when Israel destroyed the airplanes on the ground even before they could take off from that airbase in Egypt. And he was given the job in the Air Force of rebuilding the Egyptian Air Force. And he did that amazingly successfully, because by 1973, when it came around to the Yom Kippur War, Israel had to endure many attacks and a lot of aggravation from the Egyptian Air Force, which was really rebuilt by Hosni Mubarak as he was then as an Air Force officer. And of course, then he went into this role in politics, where he was the deputy president to Anwar Sadat. Sadat, of course, being the Egyptian president who signed the peace agreement with Israel. And when Sadat was assassinated as a result of his having entered into this peace agreement with Israel, it was Hosni Mubarak who took over unexpectedly, and he really wasn't primed at all, even though he was the deputy president. He didn't seem to be primed at all at that point for taking over, and it was all regarded as somewhat of a short-term fix for him just to take over as the deputy president until such time as things could be organized. And there it was. He went into this 30-year reign as president of Egypt, during which time he really reinforced the peace agreement that Sadat, his predecessor, had signed with Israel. He also came down quite toughly, quite harsh, quite firmly on the Palestinians, on our friend Arafat particularly, but also the situation with Gaza. He really was very, very firm in dealing with the whole Gaza situation, and very much supported Israel's security. So he was the one who, from at least a regime level, even though it might not have necessarily been supported from the Egyptian street, but as a regime, as a person who was running the government, did so very, very firmly indeed. He very much supported interaction with Israel, cooperation with Israel, security with Israel. And he, of course, cracked down very firmly on the Muslim Brotherhood, which ironically the president who succeeded him when eventually Mubarak was overthrown during the Arab Spring protests of 2011, I think they were. He then was succeeded by, of course, a president from the Muslim Brotherhood, which was slightly ironic, but Mohamed Morsi didn't last very long as president, only 1 year. And even though Mubarak was convicted of crimes against those protests and was even jailed for some time and had been unwell, he never ever contemplated leaving Egypt, running away, as some of the other leaders of other Arab countries did, in order to run away from what they perceived as being danger to themselves as a result of their role prior to the Arab Spring. He remained in Egypt with his family. He had groomed his son, Gamal, to be the successor. It never really happened. But it's interesting that now the current Egyptian leadership under the President al-Sisi, I think, has really emulated quite in many ways the way that Mubarak ran the country. So a fascinating and quite contradictory relationship with Israel over the years. But ultimately, Prime Minister Netanyahu has called him a friend of Israel, and I think that he was, especially in the years after the peace agreement was signed.
Yeah, I actually found this conversation to be a very important one, because it just shows that on the passing of somebody who was very involved in a world of politics, sometimes a very complicated world, it's so important to be able to look at all the different aspects, or some of the different aspects of their lives, and rather than to do what we are naturally inclined to do, which is paint him either as a hero or as a villain. And that's why I think this is very, very important, because clearly it's a very nuanced and complicated relationship that Israel has had with Mubarak.
And indeed with Egypt. I mean, not only with Mubarak, but to some degree he reflects the nuanced relationship that Israel had and still has with Egypt. But I think, as I say, you know, Mubarak went through times. He was, you know, really probably one of the more corrupt leaders. You know, we don't have particular evidence of it, but there certainly are pointers to the fact that he ran a very firm and corrupt regime. But ultimately, it seems as if the Egyptian population, at one stage, I mean, first of all, the population grew tremendously under his leadership, but also I don't know that their wealth was really increased in any significant way. So the question about his relationship with his own people is a fascinating one, which I haven't obviously spoken about here, but I think is an entirely separate conversation, because I'm not sure that he was quite as successful in dealing with his own issues with the Egyptian people as he was with dealing with relationship with Israel.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely fascinating. This story also is very interesting to me, that the Israeli high-tech industry is struggling with almost 20,000 jobs that are currently not filled. 20,000 jobs. What's the latest, what is the state of the high-tech industry in Israel?
Well, I think when we take a step back for a moment, I mean, we know, you know, the whole kind of terminology around startup nation. This is the way that Israel is often presented in the international arena. You know, Israel has obviously had some amazing successes, inventions that come out of the high-tech industry. But when we look at it as simply another industry in Israel, another area to work in and another part of our economy, then it also shows some quite interesting statistics. For example, the fact is that something like 300,000 Israelis are employed in high-tech firms across the country, and that has increased. That increases by like 8 to 10% on a year-by-year basis, and amounts to approximately 10% of all employees in Israel work within the high-tech industry. So the way that it's presented, which is that it's a very significant part of the Israeli economy, is absolutely borne out by these numbers. And what's more than that is the fact that the average salary that a high-tech employee earns is significantly higher than the general average across the country. The average that a high-tech employee earns is around 22,500 shekels a month. That's the average for high-tech and non-tech roles within the high-tech industry, which compares to something like less than 10,000 shekels a month in the remainder of the economy. So you can see how differently people are being paid in high-tech. And the other interesting thing is to see how the split is between men and women, between Arabs and Jews, and so on. And it turns out that a significant number of something like 60 or 70% of high-tech employees are actually non-Orthodox males. And only a very, very small number at the moment are Arabs, even though the Arab sector is growing quite substantially. And also the number of women is growing, but not nearly enough. And so it's just interesting to take a step back and have a look and see exactly what's going on within the high-tech industry. Of course, these 20,000 jobs mean that people with particular skills, particularly infrastructure and software programming, those kind of skills are going to be snapped up very, very quickly within high-tech here, because those are the roles that are really still unfilled. People with skills in algorithms and things like that will be snapped up very, very quickly. So it's just, you know, something different to talk about instead of the regular things that we've been forced to talk about and will be talking about for the remainder of the week.
Absolutely. Very, very interesting indeed, and fascinating to see the growth in that industry. It is 8 o'clock. This is Where We Love and Leave You. I'm Howard Feldman. We'll be back with Anthony Wright for the Israel Report tomorrow morning at 7:45 here. Is Zanati with your news.